Nuclear war. How bad could it be? I mean, isn't it just big bombs blasting away at their immediate targets? Well, no. The implications of even a so-called small-scale nuclear war would wreak havoc on life and food production, even in countries far distant from the direct line of fire. And as for a major nuclear war, it takes a genuine expert to explain.
In the larger models, or the larger scale wars that they modeled, in particular between the U.S. and Russia, the worst case scenario, we're looking at an ice age type nuclear winter scenario that could effectively bring about the extinction of humanity, because the numbers they're looking at were over 5 billion people that die in those scenarios.
5 billion people dead. Still think having nukes is a good idea? Well, when Seth Sheldon of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons explains not only what has been studied about the effects of nuclear war in the past, but why the United Nations is moving towards its first new study of the effects since 1989, you start to get a clear picture of what's so awful about that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two interviews that speak to the horrific impact of nuclear weapons, should they be used, and encouraging progress being made to wake up the world to the need to get rid of them. First, we talk with Seth Sheldon, the United Nations representative for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, on the recent UN resolution to form a scientific committee to determine what the effects would be of today's mega nuclear weapons, should they be used. These weapons are many times more powerful than the ones represented in the last UN study 25 years ago. And the fact that another scientific examination is being proposed is a major step in convincing the world that nukes are not good for people and other living things. Then we share a bit of totally unexpected good news. The International Uranium Film Festival has been invited to present films this week at the G20 Summit in Rio, and participate in a documentary being made there by director David Lynch. I talk with festival founder and director Norbert Suchanek about how this amazing opportunity came about and what it possibly means. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than most people here in the U.S. have the heart to even think about this week. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 12, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., in Maryland, in the next few weeks, officials there are expected to deliver a comprehensive plan for how state agencies will tackle the growing climate crisis. Unfortunately, the one idea that seems to be gaining the most traction in recent months is an expansion of dangerous nuclear power for electricity generation. State legislators and administration officials seem to be warming up to the radioactive idea of bringing in expensive new nuclear reactors to Maryland. According to this article from Beyond Nuclear, Marylanders should be wary of this push and the perverse notion that nuclear industry backers are using to siphon off taxpayer money for these reactors, calling them clean energy. The truth is that except for the exact moment when the atom is split to release its energy, this entire technology is dirty, leaving a trail of radioactive debris that is dangerous for literally tens of thousands of years and generates carbon for the atmosphere through construction and transportation. We'll link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 699. A little bit of good news. Hawaii was the first country in the U.S. to declare itself a nuclear-free zone, which it did in 1981. Now, the Hawaii County Council has passed a bill that repeals a 40-year-old military exemption from Hawaii County's historic nuclear-free law. The bill now goes to the mayor for his signature to officially become law. We'll have links to two very interesting articles. One, when you combine AI and nuclear power, the results can be catastrophic. Written by Linda Parks, who is on the board of Mothers for Peace, an organization committed to the decommissioning of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, the piece cites Mark Jacobson, director of Stanford's Atmosphere and Energy Program, who finds that, quote, every dollar spent on nuclear is one less dollar spent on clean, renewable energy, and one more dollar spent on making the world a comparatively dirtier and more dangerous place, because nuclear power and nuclear weapons go hand in hand. The second link asks, what if the nuclear industry really isn't safe? Ya think? It's a review of the book Making the Unseen Visible, Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure, edited by Linda Marie Richards and Jacob Darvin Hamblin. Making the Unseen Visible focuses on what is most dangerous about the nuclear industry, radiation, which is only detectable with technology but is potentially lethal, both in short-term and long-term effects. The book captures perspectives from people, often of indigenous and working-class backgrounds, who are usually overlooked and unheard in ensuing political and legal battles. Many other citizens affected were never informed either, including downwinders and bomb explosion victims. Check the link on the website, and it will send you to where you can find a copy of the book. In South Korea, the Korean Central News Agency reports that South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff say North Korea may soon carry out a nuclear test, likely using the Hwasong-31 tactical warhead introduced last year. Its relatively smaller size would enable it to be mounted on at least 7 different types of missile and can be launched from anywhere in the country using a portable launcher. In Russia's war against Ukraine, an estimated 30% of its more than 5,500 warheads are now within striking distance of Ukrainian missiles and drones, and even Ukrainian troops. Meanwhile, Ukraine is preparing for attacks on its nuclear power plants during a critical winter season. The country has lost about 50% of its generating capacity due to infrastructure damage, and the country currently has no protection against missile strikes. If Russia attacks Ukraine's nuclear infrastructure, President Zelensky warns of a nuclear disaster. Moscow is also courting fresh diplomatic and economic ties with African countries and said that it was counting on Russia training its citizens to become specialists in nuclear energy. Russia's Rosatom struck a deal in 2019 to help build nuclear power stations in the country. In the UK, Britain's nuclear bomb scandal is about to be revealed in a 3-part exposé on BBC Two. Britain's post-war nuclear weapons program put some 39,000 servicemen, scientists, and local people in close proximity to 45 nuclear bombs and hundreds of radioactive experiments. Now, a new series of 3 films raises questions about the shattering consequences of Britain's race to become a global nuclear power. This BBC Two film pieces together extraordinary testimony and pioneering journalism, weaving chilling allegations of decades of cover-up at the heart of government with shattering human cost. We will have a link to the film Britain's Nuclear Bomb Scandal on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 699. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Not again. This story just keeps popping up and will not die. France could soon begin repurposing low-level radioactive metals into reusable products. They're talking about door handles, forks, saucepans, and belt buckles, the exact places where you do not want to be exposed to radioactive waste at any level. But hey, in turning radioactive lemons into radioactive lemonade, the former director of France's energy company, EDF, has said this would make it possible to process 500,000 tons of low-level radioactive metals over a period of 40 years. End quote. Look, dude, there is no such thing as an irrelevant or insignificant exposure to radioactivity. It is cumulative, and even so-called low-level radiation continues to harm people and the environment, especially those belt buckles. In France, the public can vote on whether to greenlight this nuclear recycling scheme and the facility that would require to institute it between now and February of next year. To move the proposal forward, the nation would need to adjust its public health code, gain an environmental clearance, and use a barrage of public relations propaganda to lobotomize the majority of its population. And that's why France, EDF, and the ignorant goons behind this, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment, but first, we are coming up on the holiday season. And here at Nuclear Hot Seat, we've got a lot to celebrate. Next week marks our 700th program, 13 and a half years of covering the weekly progress and setbacks experienced by those of us who oppose nuclear around the world. Woohoo! The show is syndicated for broadcast through Pacifica, downloaded in at least 124 countries. The archive is going to be stored at the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College, and it already has been cited in more than 300 academic papers through academia.edu. Now we are approaching two major milestones, both of which require your help. The first is December 5th and 6th, when I'll be attending the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C. This first-of-its-kind in-gathering will bring together high-level mainstream media reporters from around the world who are focused on covering nuclear issues with members of government and NGOs who strive to inform them. A great place to network about our issues and talking points and find out how the media sees us and our work, and then correct them. The other is March 3 to 7 in New York, where the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons will take place at the United Nations. Last year, I attended with full press credentials, something rarely granted to a podcast, and was able to bring you personal reports on nuclear issues from around the world, shared by the people who were making the news. This year, I intend to go as well, but it's all pending your support. Both of these trips require your help if I'm to be able to go. Outrider is covering my flights and room for two nights, but nothing else. For the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons meetings, I'm on my own and have to raise all the funds. So help me expand my coverage of these important nuclear events by sending in a donation to Nuclear Hot Seat. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so your donation is tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red button, or send a donation through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Be it our milestone anniversary, the holidays, or just your interest in cutting-edge info on nuclear issues, celebrate by helping us continue to help you. nuclearhotseat.com. Whatever you can do, you have my gratitude. Now, here's the first of this week's two featured interviews. The United Nations First Committee just announced that they will be putting forward a resolution to create a 21-scientist committee to examine and determine the impact of nuclear war on people and the planet. A study of this sort has not been done since 1989, 25 years ago. And the changes in both the size of the bombs and the impact of nuclear war on the climate are top priorities to be determined. Might as well spell out the horrors while they can. To find out more, I spoke with Seth Sheldon. He is General Counsel and United Nations Liaison for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. We spoke on November 7, 2024. Seth Sheldon, it's great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Appreciate your interest.
What is your position with ICANN as regards working with the United Nations?
I have a couple of roles, but yeah, the one with the United Nations, I am the United Nations liaison for ICANN. I'm also our general counsel.
The United Nations First Committee has recently adopted a new resolution to set up a group of independent experts to study the impact of nuclear war. What is the First Committee at the United Nations and what are its responsibilities?
The General Assembly of the United Nations, after they opened, they sort of split up into committees that deal with different thematic elements that member states are trying to deal with. And the First Committee one is supposed to deal with security and disarmament issues and peace and security more generally, too. Every year as well, they table a lot of resolutions, and some of them are new. Some of them are just the same as every year that the certain states will table every year. And ICANN is interested in a number of the resolutions that impact nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament.
So FIRST refers to just being a category as opposed to sequentially, it goes through 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, in order to make progress.
Well, it's just that there are 6 committees. So then it's possible that it means that it's the most important, but I mean, it's to me, it is, but that's how it's numerically organized.
Regarding this resolution, how long has it been in the works and how did it first come about?
Well, this specific resolution has actually come about pretty quickly. And there were a lot of different groups that thought this was a good idea. But in some ways, you could say it was born out of the states' parties, certain states' parties to the TPNW, and the recommendation that was provided by a group under the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, that is. There's one element of work that is titled the Scientific Advisory Group, and they're a group of scientific and technical experts that have been designated by states' parties to the TPNW to take forward scientific and technical issues. And at the second meeting of states' parties, which was last year, 2023, the SAG, as we call them sometimes, they recommended this kind of study. And some states thought it would be a good idea to take it forward. And so Ireland and New Zealand in particular collaborated on presenting this resolution to the General Assembly. They started working on it in earnest at the beginning of this year, January 2024. This is just a couple of months after the meeting of states parties, which was November, December 2023. You know, and over the course of this year, these two states have built support from states and civil society to present it to the First Committee, which happened last week. And there was a vote on the resolution last week. And there will be another vote on the same resolution at the full plenary session of the General Assembly in December.
And what's the difference between the two votes?
Normally, the resolution would be adopted as it was in First Committee, at this sort of breakout group, I guess you could call it, of the General Assembly. And then it's presented again, along with all of the resolutions that were brought to committees for the full plenary of all the General Assembly to vote on it. Normally, the votes are the same as they were in First Committee. But owing to the fact that there are different capacities for different countries to actually show up to all of the committees, it's often the case that maybe positions don't change too much between the 2 months or so that it takes to vote the second time, but more countries show up to the plenary session and actually press the buttons. And so I'd say that the best referendum of the numbers of support and opposition is reflected by the GA vote, we say, you know, the full plenary vote at the General Assembly. But I think that's it's normally very similar to what we see at the First Committee vote.
At this First Committee vote, the UK, Russia, and France all voted against this initiative, with the UK blatantly claiming that they voted against it because, and here I quote, the consequences are well known, you know, the consequences of nuclear war. Is it possible to get them, get these countries, or the US, which abstained, to change their votes between now and December, and what might it take?
It's definitely possible to get them to change their votes. Like I said, most countries once they fix their positions after studying them for weeks or months, sometimes before the resolution is actually voted on in first committee, they're pretty locked in. But first of all, sometimes these resolutions, especially the first time they're presented, as this was with this resolution, they're really getting consulted on into the days before the vote happens at first committee. And so sometimes the positions are not super locked in and they can still be negotiated. I think in the case of some of these kinds of states, which have very well-resourced foreign ministries and have really spent a lot of time, I think, analyzing it for themselves, it's not a matter of they didn't have enough information. Rather, at this stage, in order to get them to change the vote, I think the best thing to do is to bring public pressure and to sort of call them out for what's behind them making the wrong choice in this particular case. And us talking about it here, hopefully, draw some attention to it, especially in democratic states, asking the public to ask these questions about their government and to say, well, what's behind this? And when, as is the case here, some very silly answers are given, we can help push back on these choices and do something that I think will actually, in this case, bring forward some progress that we really need.
I've heard it said often that one of the most dangerous statements that a person can say is, I already know that, as opposed to being open to learning more. And that's certainly a stance that can be taken with these countries. Which of the states and agencies within the United Nations network are in favor and supporting this resolution?
I'll talk about states first, and then more about agencies. In general, in both cases, I think you see that there's overwhelming support for taking forward this project. And we can talk about why and why it's so necessary. As you said, the response from one state, the United Kingdom, to say that, you know, we already know this stuff is really quite absurd, I think, in the context of what the resolution aims to do and how it's hopefully a way to advance the shared goals of nuclear disarmament among all states. But in terms of the United Kingdom is in quite a small minority here in terms of opposing it. We saw last week when the vote happened on this resolution that 144 countries voted in favor of it, 30 abstained, and only 3 said that it was a bad idea. And that was the United Kingdom, as you mentioned, and France and Russia. So France and the UK standing alone with Russia on this one. We saw a lot of abstentions, including from the United States, who later in their explanation of vote did also make a statement that, you know, the consequences of nuclear war are widely known, or something to this effect. But depending on how the research project and the panel of experts was put together, they might be supportive of it. Many nuclear armed states and states, you might say, are in the nuclear umbrella, so-called umbrella, or we might say nuclear dependent states, were abstainers. But not all were. In fact, of the 9 nuclear armed states, China voted in favor of it. Only these 3 states opposed it, as mentioned. And then as far as agencies, there was a process undertaken to consult and then name a few agencies in the resolution itself. But we expect that all the relevant agencies, and when we speak about agencies, it's like the World Health Organization, the Food and Agricultural Organization, these kind of agencies that are part of the UN structure and that have something to say based on their expertise around these subjects, that should be and will be engaged under this initiative.
It has been 35 years since the last review of consequences of nuclear war has been done, at least at this level. It was last addressed in 1989. Just ballpark for now, what are some of the changes that you feel or that ICANN feels need to be addressed?
If this sort of project is undertaken as we would expect it to be, you know, we know that the science will bear out that nuclear war and the consequences of nuclear war are even more far-reaching than the disastrous estimates that we saw when this project was convened at the UN last in 1989, as you said. So much has developed in the science since then. And in particular, like taking into account variables that were never previously studied, especially relating to climactic effects of nuclear war. So I think many of us over these past decades, especially if you were around in the 70s and the 80s, where people were speaking about this topic a lot more, are familiar with the concept in general of nuclear winter, what some might call nuclear winter, which is based on the notion that any use of a nuclear weapon over a industrial area or a populated area, which of course is where almost all nuclear weapons are targeted, would cause widespread and absolute catastrophic destruction in the immediate term, and then in the near term as well, and then in the long term as well. But there's something else that would happen, which is that it would cause so much of the soot and debris from the bombing to be lofted into the upper atmosphere in the mushroom cloud. Then it would be above the reach of precipitation to bring it down, and it would block out the sun and sit up there for weeks, months, potentially longer. And what scientists have been trying to model for in more recent years is what will that do to the climate in a way that was never studied back then. It was studied in this kind of comprehensive way, I think, that we've seen in recent studies. For example, there's a study from just a couple of years ago that was published in Nature Food, a journal, that demonstrates that an exchange of nuclear weapons in the context of a nuclear war would, through this climactic process that I was talking about, would cause caloric crop production to be reduced and food supply to be reduced, even in regions that are far away from where the detonations occurred, that could cause famine in totally separate parts of the world from where we saw the conflict. And they studied and modeled examples in a potential exchange of nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan, which might be said to be a limited use of nuclear weapons. And they see that in the models they run, that over 2 billion people would die in that context of this medium exchange, even if they were nowhere near the Indian subcontinent. And then in the larger models or the larger scale wars that they modeled, in particular between the US and Russia, the worst case scenario, you know, this is, we're looking at an ice age type nuclear winter scenario that could effectively bring about the extinction of humanity, because the numbers they're looking at were over 5 billion people that die in those scenarios. So that's one aspect of science that I think has developed since the 1980s that would, I would hope, be taken into account very seriously by the panel that is put together.
It states from the first committee that 21 independent experts are going to be chosen. Why 21, and what is it intended that they represent, and how will they be chosen?
Some things are not yet known. And what happened in the process of writing this resolution, shepherded by Ireland and New Zealand, was that, as is always the case, they negotiate with the states that say, well, we think there should be more experts or fewer experts, and we want it to be voluntary, we want it to be paid. You know, these sorts of details are discussed and argued. And so I don't actually remember what's special about that particular number, other than the fact that it was somewhat negotiated. And our focus now has turned to helping ensure that whoever is chosen, it represents a diverse panel that has balanced in terms of what countries they're from, what regions they're from, gender balance, and making sure that it's not stacked with the type of Western scientists that may have in the past minimized the effects of nuclear war in trying to convince their own populations that things are safe and under control. This is our priority now, I think, is making sure that it's filled with experts who are true experts in what these consequences could be and would be if nuclear weapons are used.
How will they be chosen, and by whom?
I'm not sure that I know exactly the answer to this question, because there are some things that have yet to be negotiated about taking the next steps. You know, this resolution, assuming that when it moves forward, it will have to go through another committee that has yet to determine, because it has a budgetary implication, so it has to get voted on there. And I think these are exactly the questions that states are asking themselves right now. Like the U.S. in their explanation of vote had some of these questions. I don't know where they were going with it exactly, but some of the specifics I don't know, and I'm not sure who does know about how people are chosen on the panel yet. Like I said, our priority is that the people that are chosen are fairly represent what recent science has been and are not along the lines of, you know, let's say what we heard from some of the states that gave explanations of vote, like the one you read, where they say, oh, we already know this stuff and nothing more needs to be done. That's quite antithetical to our vision of what this panel should be producing.
By what time is it either expected or hoped that this panel of scientists is going to be put together? And what kind of timeline do they have for doing their work? And what are they supposed to come up with at the end of it?
Again, I don't have the actual any deadlines in my head at the moment. I believe that the idea is for this work to be taken forward in three phases, I believe, is what I recall from the consultations, and that it would be, I believe, over the course of 3 years to do that work. So that would mean that the final result, maybe that's 3 years out.
ICANN has an extensive international network of campaigners, especially young campaigners, which is quite impressive. How have they been working in their countries as regards this resolution?
I would say, for the most part, and as I mentioned, that this resolution has come together pretty quickly over the course of this past year. And the general perspective from the states introducing it was that we shouldn't really need a ton of grassroots civil society activism to bring about something that's so obvious. And we tended to agree that it shouldn't really certainly be necessary to get their majority of states to support it. So it hasn't been something that I think was done, especially in the early stages, with a lot of grassroots advocacy. We did consult on the project from the beginning and talk to them, and along with a lot of other partners in the scientific community. But ICANN was in touch from the very start with the drafters to give our views. But we didn't activate all of the call your ministry, call your president sort of activism, because it didn't seem like at the time it would be the best use of our resources. You know, we are quite focused at ICANN on getting states to support the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons as the real solution. And there's a number of resolutions that relate to that. So that's always been generally our primary focus, and certainly in these past couple of years. But as we moved toward the vote and it became clear how states would vote, and we realized that certain states might oppose it, we did start activating campaigners in the ICANN network to talk to their governments and ensure that they did the right thing on this particular resolution about nuclear war effects. One example is the Germans, who were quite cool to the resolution in the days before the vote. And at that point, I think it was quite effective when we told our German partners about that. And they really activated around telling the government that it was imperative that they support it. And in that process, they really helped make sure that Germany did vote yes on the resolution, whereas even days before, it seemed like they might vote no. So that's one example. There were a few other countries in which we did, but as I said, with the vast majority of states, 144 of them voting in favor, it didn't seem like that was the urgent work from the campaign that was.
Do you know yet the date that the vote is going to take place?
In the plenary session, it's usually the first week of December. I actually think it may have been set in the last day or two, maybe not yet. I know that was everyone's been asking. So I could probably, by the time you publish this, we will know, because the last day of first committee is tomorrow. And then I expect that we will set the date for all the voting, and then if not by now, then in the next couple of days. But we can figure sometime between like December 2nd and 13th, probably.
That's going to be the time frame where there is the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit taking place in Washington, D.C. That's going to be the 5th and 6th of December. And that would be an excellent time and place to bring it up so that all the reporters who are there from around the world can be exposed to the need to cover this. And if the vote hasn't happened, that it's coming up. And if the vote has happened, that they need to have something about it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm actually going to DC, I think is where the Outrider event is. Is that right?
Yeah.
Those same days, but I actually wasn't sure if I could make it to this program too. But yes, I agree with you. And I think that it's a good opportunity, but it's also a good opportunity, I think, to discuss the many, I would say, larger issues that this resolution does relate to. Repositioning today, dealing with the next U.S. presidential administration, it will be really a moment where that will be one of the main topics, I think, is what we're all thinking about in the context of advocacy around the next administration. And like I say, it relates to this resolution, but I think there's some larger topics to cover too, probably at that time.
If listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat wish to get involved, become campaigners, or somehow align themselves with ICANN and the work you're doing on the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons, what should they do? Where can they go?
Maybe I should then introduce us and then point you to our website, which is at ICANW.org. And ICANN, we are a campaign founded in 2007 that seeks to abolish and eliminate nuclear weapons. And we are largely responsible as the civil society movement that helped bring about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And it was for our work on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and to raise awareness about the consequences of any use of nuclear weapons that we won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. And since then, we've been working to implement this treaty and universalize this treaty. So there are so many ways to get involved. And if you work with an organization, that's how we typically bring in our campaigners, where generally we consist of NGOs or nonprofit organizations that care about this issue. They range greatly in terms of what their core focus might be, but they would all agree that nuclear weapons must be eliminated and the TPNW is the way to do it. And you can join as a partner organization. And today we are over 700 partner organizations in 110 countries. But as an individual, you can join one of our partner organizations. In the U.S., we have over 60 around that number. And they're all working with us on the TPNW as well. And you can find them on our website. Then there's lots of local initiatives that people have been taking forward, including, just to give a couple of examples, the ICANN Cities Appeal Project, where we get different cities around the U.S., a lot of big cities like everywhere from Los Angeles to New York and Washington, D.C., to say that even though the federal government opposes the TPNW, this city supports it. We have similar sorts of initiatives with the Congressional Pledge or the Parliamentary Pledge, where we get members of Congress to say that even though the federal government opposes the treaty, that they pledge to support the treaty. We have divestment initiatives, where you can help take your money out of the very few companies, by the way, that manufacture or maintain nuclear weapons. And we have projects, if your listeners are affiliated with universities, let's say, they should check out our Schools of Mass Destruction report, which helps identify which schools are most involved in the nuclear weapons industry. Essentially, wherever you're working, in whatever space you're working, there's a role for you with us. And that's almost the essence of the campaign, is that for so many decades of failure to disarm states, I think our adversaries, which is just a few people in a few countries, have succeeded by making sure that this was an issue that was sort of cloistered away from the general populace as something that required the special expertise of military strategists or nuclear physicists. And it's been our movement that's helped illustrate that that's not the case. We're basically just talking about big, clumsy weapons that are totally indiscriminate and that cannot be used in any manner that's compatible with international law, and that everyone has a say in whether or not we continue to rely on them for national defense. So we've worked really to make sure that everyone understands that the real experts are the scientists who know what nuclear weapons will do, the doctors who know that there's no adequate response to any use of nuclear weapons, and ordinary people who are targeted, and most of all, survivors who, whether from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also from the over 2,000 uses of nuclear weapons and so-called testing, and the many affected communities here in the United States, who can tell us firsthand what nuclear weapons are already doing to them and their communities.
It's a wide range of focus that you have, but it all leads to one thing, which is get rid of nukes. The work of ICANN has been remarkable. It's important that there's going to be this new study coming out on the impact of nuclear weapons, because I think people have moved away from it thinking, oh, it can be used to break up a hurricane, or it's just a big bang with no aftermath, when, of course, the radiation and, as you spoke about, the nuclear winter and so many other aspects will be unavoidable. Nuclear is good for nobody. So with all of this on your plate, and the work you've been doing, I really appreciate you taking the time today to speak with us. And thanks for being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, Libby. It's really great to be here and speak about what we're working on.
That was Seth Sheldon, General Counsel and United Nations Liaison for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear War, ICANN. I checked with Seth right before recording this, and as of now, while we expect the United Nations General Assembly plenary voting to proceed on December 2nd, this still hasn't been confirmed. We'll keep you posted.
Activists, shout out.
These days, we need all the good news we can get. And this next story is an unexpected shot in the arm. The International Uranium Film Festival has been officially invited to present nuclear films at the G20 Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The Group of 20 is an intergovernmental forum comprising 19 sovereign countries, the European Union, and the African Union. It works to address major issues related to the global economy, such as international financial stability, climate change mitigation, and sustainable development. Rio de Janeiro is hosting the G20 summit this week, from Wednesday the 13th of November to Friday the 15th. That makes Rio the epicenter of global diplomacy under the theme, Building a Just World and a Sustainable Planet. And the question of nuclear disarmament is now part of the G20 side events. The International Uranium Film Festival has been invited by the G20 to present films during the meetings. It will also be included as part of a documentary covering the summit being shot with David Lynch as executive director. This is huge visibility for the Uranium Film Festival and the voices of those who oppose nuclear. To find out how this came about so quickly and what's involved, I spoke with Norbert Suchanek. Along with Marcio Gomez de Oliveira, he is founder and director of the International Uranium Film Festival. Amidst the sudden surge of activity to pull off this tremendous opportunity, he found time to talk with us on November 8, 2024. Norbert Suchanek, it's great to have you with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby, to be again with you today.
There has been a request made for the International Uranium Film Festival to present films in Rio during the G20 summit, which is taking place next week, November 14 through 16. What was the exact request, and what group or from what entity or individuals did this request come?
Okay, we got the invitation from people from the art movement from New York and Brazil. And in fact, it was invitation from Zafira and Ventura Media and Entertainment and from David Lynch Institute.
The filmmaker,
exactly. And he's going to make a documentary on the G20 event too. And we are going to be part of it.
That's wonderful news, because that gives the festival an afterlife in a completely separate piece of media.
Yes. And everything started with the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize for the Hibakusha from Japan. Everybody woke up, wow, they got the Nobel Peace Prize. And there is now the G20 event in Rio de Janeiro questioning what is going on with the future. And they asked us, oh, you know many people from the Hibakusha, so maybe we can join with the Uranium Film Festival to make something happen here in Rio.
So this is being supported or backed by the David Lynch Institute and by the Hibakusha?
No, it's supported by the David Lynch Institute and by people from the art movement in New York by the Fiera and Ventura Media Corporation. They're working with arts between Brazil and United States. And it's in fact supported by the government of Brazil, because the government of Brazil is always has been always in favor to get rid of nukes, to get rid of nuclear arms. And this is exactly the point why we are now involved.
This is wonderful news. Is it something that has been in the works for a while, or was this a request that was just made very quickly?
Oh, just very quickly. It was 3 weeks ago we received the invitation because of the announcement of the Nobel Prize award to the Hibakusha. And you must know, we have in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, a huge community of Hibakusha living there. And since the first Iranian Film Festival that happened 2011 in Rio, we are friends and involved with the Hibakusha in Sao Paulo.
What did you have to do on such short notice to pull together screenings of films as part of this new iteration of the International Uranium Film Festival?
First, what we are doing now is to get the Hibakusha to Rio de Janeiro. The idea is to bring the Hibakusha from Sao Paulo and at least one representative from the Hibakusha from Japan to Rio to present their stories themselves to all those politicians and the staff of all those people who are coming to Rio to learn about what is Hibakusha. And we already can confirm that the Hibakusha from Sao Paulo are going to be there. And second, during the event, we are going to have a couple of hours to screen films about Nagasaki, about Hiroshima, about the horrors of nuclear bombs, about nuclear bomb testing to the audience of the G20.
Is this going to be an official presentation to them, meaning it's under the umbrella of the G20, or is this going to be something on the outside that you hope they will come to?
It's going to be under the umbrella of the G20 events.
This is huge!
Yeah, this is huge, because you invite us 3 weeks before the event. How can we do this? But, you know, we thought it's so important. We have to stop all our other things. We have now to arrange the screenings and to get everybody into what we are wanting to do.
Do you have a venue yet? And have you chosen the films? And if so, which ones are they?
Well, in fact, the venue we have. The venue is one of the first-class venues in Rio de Janeiro. It's Parque das Arenas. It's one of the best, how would you say? It's on top of Rio de Janeiro. It's a very old mansion in Santa Teresa, which the government of Rio decided to be a cultural center. It's the Park of the Ruins, we call it. And they have a beautiful theater in there. And in fact, it's just coincidence. Our first international Iranian Film Festival happened over there in 2011. And now we return.
This is such good news. Now, how long will the festival be? How many days? And how many films will that allow you to show?
It's planned to have the festival between November 12th to November 20th. But until now, we do not have the exact times. We are still working it out because we are going to have also lots of other movements and events parallel to the festival. And we are still waiting for the final schedule. We may show 10 films, 8 or 20. It's still open. We are still working on it. But I can tell you, I'm going to open the event with a film by Peter Greenaway. It's a film that he sent to our first International Radio Film Festival 2011. It's called Atomic Bombs on the Planet Earth. It's a short film showing more than 2,000 atomic bombs exploding on planet Earth.
It certainly will be Well, hopefully it will be a wake-up call and a true representation of how extensive the nuclear incursion on our planet, on our people, and the environment this technology has been.
It shows the madness of nuclear, the madness of creating bombs that can destroy our humanity. And I think the G20 event, it has the goal to show ways for sustainability and to show how we can save our planet. It's so important that we include the nuclear question, because we cannot have a safe planet, a sustainable planet, if we have thousands of nuclear bombs waiting to explode. It's not sustainable. And we have to get rid of nuclear bombs. No more Hibakusha. For that, we were invited.
Will there be any events or a panel discussion or other representation of the Hibakusha during the festival?
Yes, of course. We have our film screenings, and we have invited the Hibakusha from Brazil, Sao Paulo, to be part of the event and to meet with the Hibakusha from Japan. We are not sure if it really can happen that both can meet here in Rio de Janeiro, because at the moment we have close relationships with Sao Paulo and Japan, and the Hibakusha from Japan say we have every second call from around the world to go to somewhere. So it's not sure that they may come to Rio, but we are pretty sure that we are going to have our Hibakusha from Sao Paulo in Rio, and that they are going to have their speech in French in front of the G20 presidents. I think Joe Biden is coming to Rio, so I'm pretty sure that Joe Biden are going to meet our Hibakusha.
I cannot begin to express how proud I am that the outreach happened, that the IUFF is directly involved in this, and that you will be making this information through film available to the leaders of the world.
Yes, we are so proud too. It's fantastic. And it happens because of one of our friends, Miguel Silveira, filmmaker from Brazil, working in Chicago. And you remember?
Of course I remember Miguel. Who could forget Miguel?
You have been here Rio. And he contracted a local filmmaker to film us here in Rio de Janeiro. And this local filmmaker was contracted by the people from New York City, together with David Lynch, to make the film. And so we have the connection. Everything is going around, you know. And because of Miguel Silveira, we are connected with all the groups of David Lynch, and now we are inside of the G20 event. It's because they had no idea about how to contact Hibakusha. They knew, they received the award, but who knows them? And we know them. We know them since 2011. And so the connection was made. Filmmakers, Hibakusha, and us.
In the best of all possible outcomes, what do you hope will happen as a result of this new set of presentations to the G20?
I am pretty sure that this will help us to really to get more countries to get rid of nuclear weapons. And it will help us, I'm pretty sure, to get our film festival more known. And maybe it's going to help us to bring our film festival next year to New York, too.
That would be wonderful. Certainly in early March is the third meeting of states parties at the United Nations on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Fundraising permitting, I will be there to cover it for Nuclear Hot Seat, and it would be fabulous to have the festival there at the same time.
Well, it would be fabulous to meet you in New York at the same time.
Norbert Sukhanek, at this time in the United States, in this community, we have needed a piece of good news. And this has got to rank as the best thing I've heard, certainly since November 5th. So on behalf of myself and the listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for bringing us up to date on this exciting new story for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby, to have invited me to talk about what happened here in Rio, because we have to get rid of nuclear weapons as soon as possible.
International Uranium founder and director Norbert Sukhanek. The films being shown as part of the G20 are Atomic Bombs on the Planet Earth by Peter Greenaway, Nuclear Savage, The Islands of Secret Project 4.1 by Adam Horowitz about the bombing of the Marshall Islands and its deadly aftermath, a dance performance, It's Not the End, Academy Award-nominated Building Bombs by Mark Morey, Susan J. Robinson, and Kirsten Larvik, The Story of Hibakusha, A-Bomb Survivor, Mr. Morita by Roberto Fernandez, and Atomic Cover-Up by Greg Mitchell. We'll have a link up to where you can find more information about the festival and the IUFF's involvement at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 699. We will also have a link up to a new film on the story of Britain's post-war atomic weapons program, its devastating legacy for the thousands of service people who took part, and the impact on their families and indigenous communities. The links to this three-film series will be up on our website, of course. And a reminder that our contact form on the website has been fixed. So if you've been trying to get in touch and haven't heard back, it's because we didn't hear. Now we can. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 12, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to not miss out on a single episode. Best way for us, sign up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, by filling out the information in that big honking yellow box that pops up. You really can't miss it. First name, email address, it's yours. Or if you're a regular listener to podcasts, go to your favorite podcast platform and you can sign up there. Either way, you will be guaranteed to not miss out on a single episode of the show. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. It can be in honor of this landmark 700th episode, the holidays, the upcoming events we'll be covering, or just because you feel like it. Anything helps, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, the problem of nuclear weapons ends by its use or its elimination. That's a quote from Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations. So there you have it. You have just received your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.